I'm Bob Boylan on this edition of All Songs Considered, a conversation with Dan Auerbach. Dan Auerbach's living the dream. It's a dream he's worked hard to make real. In 2010, the Black Keys guitarist and singer moved to Nashville from his home in Ohio, and he set up shop. And that shop is called Easy Eye Sound. It's a modest studio I went to see in Nashville, where we had the conversation. It's well curated with a great old mixing console, hand-built speakers, hand-picked guitars. There were easily more than 20 of them around the studio. Organs, chimes, cool mics, drums, amps, and more things to drool at than I can handle. And the best thing of all is that it's not a museum. It's a place for friends to gather, write songs, and lay down tracks. And that's exactly what happened on this brilliant new solo album called Waiting on a Song. Dan gathered Nashville cats together, including the legendary John Prine, the king of instrumental guitar rock, Duane Eddy, and names that are the backbone of Memphis and Nashville studios, including drummer Gene Chrisman and keyboardist Bobby Wood. He also managed, on a whim, to ask Mark Knopfler to add a guitar to one of his tracks. The result is a timeless rock and roll record that conjures the best of what AM radio felt like. First-rate formula songs with a familiar verse, chorus, and sometimes there's a bridge. These were songs you wanted to sing along to. And like the songs on this record, they feel immediately like old friends. And as I look around the studio and see all the gear and think about Dan's music, I start the conversation by asking him of his passion for things that seem older than he is. You seem to be in love with things that are older than you are.
Well, I like certain sounds, that's for sure. But I mean, everything we cut here is on computer, you know. I'm not like fanatical about it.
Yeah.
Up to a certain point. I mean, I like my drums in mono, not because they sound old, but I think they hit harder. You know, they just, they're tougher sounding to my ear. Just sort of pick from each decade with the parts that I like.
What you just said about the drums reminded me of this, something we just posted today online, which was the Giles Martin interview we talked a little bit about with the Sergeant Pepper. And one of the things that he had the hardest time doing when they took remixing Sergeant Pepper from what it was, the thing that worked best in mono were the drums. And the hardest things, he wanted to spread them out a little bit, but every time he did it, it just fell flat. He managed to have a nice compromise in there, but that is true that, like, you put on a 45 with a mono 45 with and the drums just always popped right out.
It pretty much felt like everything I was ever taught about recording was always wrong, you know. And it wasn't until I really got hands-on and met some people who made records that I love that I started to really listen for the first time.
Can you think about some of the, like, a great drum sound from an old record?
Anything on Willie Mitchell records I think sound great. I think Willie Mitchell's, he's sort of one of the heroes for me of sound. He was confident with his mixing. It was always left, right, center. Drums were always mono, generally. Very tough. You know, the horns were really loud. Vocals were really loud and in your face. You know, and that was back when everybody was using reverb, and Willie Mitchell was had everything dry.
If I play, let's see.
I'm so in love with you. Whatever you want to do is all right.
Those drums are just galloping there. That's Al Green singing, of course. Let's Stay Together.
Yeah, everything's right there, right in front of your face. You can see every part. You know, he doesn't hide behind any effects or anything.
Yeah.
All the parts had to be great, you know.
Do you think they cut this, like, all in the same room at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah, this would be all mostly live except for probably the background vocals and horns.
Huh.
They would overdub the horns and strings. Yeah, but they had a vocal booth for Al, so he could sing live with the band if he wanted to. I don't know if he had to keep those takes, though.
Ooh, they had a little blast there. Hang on.
Let's be together, loving you weather, weather. Times are good or bad, happy or sad.
What was playing around the house when you were growing up?
Well, Al Green played all the time, yeah. And the Beatles played all the time. Motown stuff was on all the time. Stax, Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, Allman Brothers, you know, that kind of stuff was on all the time.
You want to pick something from, let's say, when you were kind of on the younger side?
Yeah, I mean, you know what was on all the time was Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers.
Oh, yeah?
They had a specialty comp that we played on record all the time at the house. You know, like Touch the Hem of His Garment. Songs like that.
Whoa, there was a woman in the Bible days. She had been sick, sick so very long. But she heard my Jesus was passing by. So she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, what are you trying to do? She said, if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole. She cried, oh, Lord. Till she had no more to spare. The doctors, they done all they could, but their medicine would do no good. When she touched him, the Savior didn't see, but still he turned around and cried, somebody touch me. She said, it was I who just wanna touch the hem of your garment. I know I'll be made whole right now. She stood there crying, oh, 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 and oh, oh, Lord, and oh, Lord. Said if I could just touch the hem of your garment, I know I'll be made whole right now.
Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers around. My house would only be this secular stuff. I never heard this stuff growing up.
So I would hear some of that just because my dad was, you know, he had those records. So I would hear that, but then when we get together with my family, they'd sing bluegrass songs, and they were a lot of them were spirituals too, like Stanley Brothers Angel Band. You know, I remember singing that one every time we got together. I mean, that was one of our favorite songs. That was my grandma's favorite song, and when she passed away, we sang that song at her grave.
This is on your mom's side? Or?
Yeah, on my mom's side.
So your mom's side were the players?
Mm-hmm. My mom's side were the players. My dad's side were the listeners.
And you fell right in the smack in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, would you sing along, like even as a 10-year-old
Well,
or something?
I mean, I was always really interested, but I didn't really have the confidence to kind of sing out loud. But they encouraged me, you know, my uncle taught me some songs to play, some basics and stuff. So,
on a guitar.
Mm-hmm, yeah, taught me my first songs.
When did you first hold a guitar? What?
Probably, oh man, we would have been young, really young, just because they were at family reunions. Uh-huh. So even when I wasn't playing with them, you know.
Let's listen to Angel Band by the Stanley Brothers.
My latest sun is sinking fast. My race is nearly run. My strongest trials now are past. My triumph has begun. Oh,
snow-white wings to my immortal home. Oh, bear me away on your snow-white wings to my immortal home.
Was religion strong in your home, or is it just that there's the soul in this music that comes through that's important?
Yeah, it was just the music. It was all about the music. You know, I don't know why my family played bluegrass, I guess. You know, my grandma, she was from Georgia, but that doesn't really explain it. I don't know. It was in Ohio. Bluegrass was all over Ohio. Huh. I don't know. But that would have been my biggest influence. That made me want to pick up the guitar.
And play what? I mean, did you try to play this stuff?
I tried to play that stuff. Like, those were the songs that, like, I wasn't trying to play anything modern, really. I was trying to play those songs. You know, they would teach me, like, any of the bluegrass songs, stuff like Peggy Day from that Nashville Skyline record, and that was one of the first songs
I listened to. Dylan, Johnny Cash record, for those who've not heard that.
Yeah.
Stop the interview right now. Go listen to it. It's only about a 35-minute record. Come back. We'll be right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would imagine myself in high school walking into my 10th grade class playing Angel Band by the Stanley Brothers, that's not going to go over so well if people want to play rock and roll or something.
Yeah, no, I mean,
thing or...
I've never really, like, had a lot of buddies that wanted to sit around and listen to, like, Yazoo record comps.
Right.
You know what I mean? That was what I did in my free time. When I was with my friends, we would listen to whatever was popular or whatever. I mean, we would listen to lots of hip-hop when I was in middle school and high school, and some rock and roll stuff, too, but... Mm-hmm. When I was at home, I did have my own little world that I would like to go into and practice and listen. And then when I got into college, when I sort of got away from those friends and those circles, that's when I really dove deep into, you know, stuff that no one was listening to, like Junior Kimbrough. You know, I couldn't find anybody who even ever had heard of him, you know what I mean, let alone listen to him.
Pulled this off of YouTube. This is a video of them, and it looks like an old wood shack. What's the
story? That was his place. That was his club.
Wow.
So he'd play on Sundays, and people would pay to come in, and that's how he made money.
That's really good.
But that's where the guys from Fat Possum Records saw him and decided to put out his albums. And, you know, that was my destination when I was driving to the South, when I was 17, 18, making those trips from Ohio to try to see music. Junior was my goal that I wanted to see, but I would stop in Nashville and stop in Memphis and stop in Clarksdale and, you know, in these other different cities to sort of experience the music firsthand.
What is it that Nashville, I mean, you've been here 10 years or so?
I've been here about 8 years.
8 years. What is it that it offers you that you couldn't do back in Ohio, or that maybe you wouldn't have done in Memphis?
I mean, there's just so many musicians everywhere, and some of the greatest musicians that made some of my favorite records of all time, all over the city. I mean, that's it. That's why I came here.
In fact, one of those many of those great musicians are on this new record. So let's talk about some of those.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go Duane Eddy territory.
Duane Eddy, I met a few years ago through a mutual friend of ours. We went out and had lunch, but I really got to know Duane when he first came to the studio, because he walked in and his eyes lit up, and I could just tell that he loved being in studios. He was one of us, you know. And so when I started recording last summer, he was just here all the time, just playing, just because he wanted to be here.
So working on a song with him, what did you work on, and how did it come to?
Man, we worked on dozens of songs together, really. I mean, he played guitar on tons of stuff. I mean, he was just like another one of the session guys. When we cut here, we'd have 7, 8, 9 people all playing at the same time, and everyone was the Duane Eddy of their instrument.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, there's Duane on guitar and baritone guitar, doing his magic, and then there's people like Gene Chrisman on drums, who played drums on Natural Woman by Aretha Franklin, and Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield, and I'm in Love by Wilson Pickett. So he's here playing drums, and then Bobby Wood, who played on Sweet Caroline by Neil Diamond and Suspicious Minds, and In the Ghetto by Elvis, he's playing Wurlitzer.
Wow.
The room is filled with all of these incredible people, but the thing that everyone has in common is that they wouldn't rather be anywhere else than in the studio.
So we don't get too far afield from Duane. What should I play from?
You should play Stalkin'. I love that song.
All right. Tell me everything you... Oh, wait a minute. Tell me everything you love about this recording.
Every part's perfect. That's what I love about it.
It conjures up just a time and a place.
It's a place in your mind.
Yeah.
It's not just a sound.
Right.
It creates a whole scene. It's a backdrop. And that's what these guys do, is they create spaces, landscapes.
I think it's best described for me as you put it on in a room, and it completely changes the room.
Mm-hmm.
The vibe. It's just a vibe. It's
mm-hmm.
just a,
absolutely.
And you could be anywhere, and all of a sudden you are in this place that they created. This case, 1959, 60,
mm-hmm.
roughly.
Yeah, Duane was in Phoenix. He was trying to get work. Lee Hazelwood was engineering and producing records locally, and he met Lee Hazelwood through the radio station or something. I don't know. They created the guitar sound together by like going out and buying a giant water drum and then shooting the sound in with a speaker and picking up with a microphone. So, but they did that together. Well,
like,
you know,
a water tank?
A big giant water tank. Yeah, huge one. That they needed a flatbed truck to carry, to bring it to the studio.
I want to be in the moment they thought, I've got it. Here's how we get the sound that we want.
And it worked.
And it did work.
And it worked, and they had top 10 songs that were instrumentals. It just seems so crazy to me.
Yeah. Let's hear some of Duane Eddy on your record, on Waiting on a Song. What do you want to play?
Let's play King of One Horse Town, and then he comes in sort of in the beginning. That's the first time you hear him on the record. That's where Duane makes his entrance.
Would you know who's doing what on some of this? Can you walk us through some of it?
I mean, I know who's playing every single little part of it, every second.
Can I just go back to the beginning again and tell me who's...
Well, you know what? Here comes Duane right here.
All right. Who's doing the, is it, I don't even know, are they strings or keys?
Strings are real. Yeah, yeah, the strings. The strings are strings.
P.S., yeah.
P.S., the strings are strings.
And who's doing the organ there?
That's Bobby Wood on the Wurlitzer and the Hammond there. Mm-hmm. And Bobby Wood, he, he played on all kinds of records. I mean, he played on, Sweet Caroline. You know, okay. Sweet Caroline. Ba, ba, ba. Uh-huh. Bobby wrote that part. Wow. The ba, ba, ba. He wrote that on Wurlitzer, and then they doubled it with horns.
I see.
And got rid of his Wurlitzer.
Oh.
And he played the Farfisa on Little Red Riding Hood by Sam the Sham
of the Pharaohs.
I mean, but then he also played on Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues by Danny O'Keefe. And
ooh, let's do that.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Let's play a little Danny O'Keefe. Who's this?
This is Bobby Wood on the Wurlitzer, Gene Chrisman on drums, and the rest of the Memphis Boys from American Sound Studios.
Everybody's gone away. I believe this time they're gonna stay. There's not a soul I know around. Everybody's leaving town. Some caught a freight, some caught a plane. Find the sunshine, leave the rain. They said this town will waste your time. I guess they're right, it's wasting mine. Some gotta win, some gotta lose. Good time Charlie's got the blues.
That hesitation when he does the, so I'm going to win, so I'm going to lose.
That's
and then it.
It
just stops right
time
there.
Time stretches, stands right, still.
And then the organ comes.
And you hear that flutter. It takes you somewhere.
Oh.
That song, and that's Reggie playing that guitar solo there.
Reggie
Young, he was part of the crew there. And these are guys who played on Wilson Pickett records. They played on Elvis records. They had number one pop songs. That was a number one country song. They just crossed all these boundaries. It didn't make any sense. And I feel like that's why we get along, because they come here and it's the same. It's like we draw from everything, but we're not really reporting to anyone in particular.
Right.
We can do whatever we want, you know?
Your record doesn't fall into one.
No. I mean, that last song, that was a number one country song. That was sort of a country guitar solo, but not really.
Yeah.
And
it also was a crossover hit, too.
Bubba's playing funky. Yeah.
Yeah. We sold a ton of those 45s when I worked at Waxy Maxies in Rockville, Maryland back in those days.
It's a beautiful song.
Yeah, it really is. Can you point something to, let's go back to your record on Waiting on a Song and talk about a vibe or a feeling that you feel like you really, I mean, the whole record's got it, but is there a particular thing that you could say, oh my gosh, I really...
That has something like in the vein of that, you mean?
Well, in the vein of just you like the Duane Eddy and that it just has a defining sound that when you turn it on.
Well, I mean, Waiting on a Song was the one where I knew I wanted that song to be on the record, and then all the other songs that I picked followed that one.
Okay, let's play Waiting on a Song.
I've been thinking, I've been humming, I've been picking and I've been strumming, just waiting, waiting on a song. I've been hitching, I've been thumbing, I can almost hear one coming, I just waiting.
Rumbling distortion that's spread at the bottom of that song is just beautiful. That's you, right?
That's me. That's got to be me.
And then we're in the room where you recorded that, right? So could you just describe this?
Drummers
this
right there.
Studios.
Drummers right there in the booth.
Right.
Which is not really a booth. It's kind of open. So, but he's there behind the little wall. And then the guitars are all right here. And I was playing acoustic in that room, sitting on a stool, so you could see me right through that window there.
This room is, what would you say, the length? I don't know. Maybe 60 feet?
Maybe 40 by 30, I don't know. Uh-huh. But that's, and then Bobby would be there on Wurlitzer. And
because this room is filled with every possible instrument.
Yeah.
Well, not every, but yeah, there's pianos and Wurlitzers, uprights, is probably 20 guitars that I can't see the back of my head.
Dave Rose on bass right there, mm-hmm. watching the drums, and I'm watching everybody through that window. Me and Russ Paul sat in there playing acoustics. And, you know, I mean, it's really sounded a lot like that in the headphones when we cut it. That's the exciting thing, mm-hmm. cutting with all these guys. I mean, you really hear, it sounds like that when you're playing. You sound, for me, sometimes it gets a little surreal because it sounds like
done.
I'm in a record that I'm familiar with. You know?
And who's on the other side? Who's on the console?
That's Alan. He's always in the control
Alan's
room.
Alan's last name is?
Alan Parker's. He's in there. He's my engineer and runs the studio, and sweet Sean and Alex are running around here. It's just a well-oiled machine, really. I mean, all the bells that you hear are right there, and they're all set up. And I mean, all the sounds that you hear on that record, they're in this room, and we do them very quickly. You know, we'll cut that song and do overdubs in an hour and a half, and we're already moved on to something else.
Wow. And rehearsal time up to that is?
We don't have any rehearsal.
How would you give this song to this band of people?
I play it for them right before we record it on a little demo with me just singing with acoustic. And they'll write down the changes,
uh-huh.
and then we'll talk about an approach. And then everyone sits down and tries to focus on coming up with parts. And then we try to work it out. We work out the arrangement live together with the headphones, everybody chiming in, throwing ideas around. And
I guess that's the beauty of working with people who are so seasoned.
Yeah, but also working with them so much together. I mean, we were working every week together for a year. I mean, it was just like,
wow.
They were always, even when we didn't have sessions, people would be here hanging out. Just Bobby would always stop by and just, he'd sing background vocals and stuff. It was just complete creativity. So it had everyone's attention, you know.
And the songwriting on this, on that particular song, is not just you.
That's me, and that's John Prine and Pat McLaughlin, yeah.
That's a team. That is quite a team. And how does the songwriting between, I don't know who did what in this. Are you sitting in the same room together? Or are you passing sound files? Or
that's how this record started, was through songwriting sessions, which I'd never done before. You know, the thing that Nashville's known for is that songwriting tradition, but I'd never done it. I'd always kind of been on tour, and I used the studio as a writing tool with the Black Keys and with the Arcs. I would always be in the studio creating the song, you know, working with people. This was more traditional songwriting in a room somewhere, not in the studio. Just a couple acoustic guitars, coming up with the melody and the
lyrics.
And just
handwriting down the...
Handwriting, and then you record a little demo when you get it together. And I started just doing it regular, every day. And I'd meet with the same people every week, and it just got going. The groove started happening, and just became very fruitful, very fast.
If you were to define the difference between a Dan Auerbach record and a Black Keys record and a Arcs record, would that be the central core difference is the way the songs were written?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all just who's involved, really, okay. is how it's going to change. Mm-hmm. But everything will have a common thread. That'll be me, and if it sounds familiar, it's because I'm the filter. But every project I do is different because of the people I work with, and that's what makes having the studio so fun, is that every time I invite someone here, it's a new experience, you know?
You told me about growing up and how your dad was a pretty damn big Dire Straits fan, Knopfler fan.
Yeah, he was a huge Mark Knopfler fan. When we were in the car, Salt and Swing would always be on the radio. Mm-hmm. I mean, Northeastern Ohio. There are certain songs that just got played all the time. That was one of them. And inevitably, at the end of the song, the DJ would start to fade a little early.
Because it's long.
Because it's a long guitar solo. You know what I mean? He's got stuff to sell. So they'd start to fade a little early, and that's when my dad would start screaming at the radio, just cursing the guy for fading out the solo.
Is there a chance your dad's going to listen to this? Because if so, he can yell at me. I'm Bob.
Get a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, south of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain, they hear the jazz. But the horns, they blowing that sound way on down south, way on down south, London town. Check out Guitar George, he knows all the chords. Mighty strictly rhythm, he doesn't want to make it cry all
just
sing.
Did an interview in London with BBC, and the girl there said her dad used to play with Guitar George.
Oh. I used to think that it was referring to George Harrison, but not.
Apparently there was a guy named Guitar George who knew all the chords.
And I'm going to go and play, so we're familiar with that sound. We could get down on the end, but your dad's just going to yell at me no matter what
I do,
right?
Yeah, you know what it is. Everyone knows.
So I'm going to play, and you just point it out, and we'll play some of Shine On Me. Clear as a bell. So unlike most of this record where this all happens in this room.
Yeah, the guy.
That was not true of Mr. Mark Knopfler.
He was the wild card. Yeah, he was the one who I heard in this room, but only in my head. I played it back after we recorded it. I was in the control room sitting at the console there, and I heard his guitar. I could just hear it. It just sounds, it sounds like Mark Knopfler should be on this song. So we made a mix that night, a rough mix, sent it to my manager, and I said, find Mark Knopfler's email, send him this, ask him nicely. I don't know. I've never met him. I don't know. I didn't know. And then 2 days later, he sent the song back with the guitar on it.
It wasn't just like, yeah, I could probably get to it.
He just did it.
He just did it.
And you know what? What was so perfect is that he didn't play a big honking guitar solo because it didn't need it. It just needed a rhythm guitar. It just needed his little rhythm touch on it. And that's all he did. And I didn't even have to talk to him about it or anything. It was perfect.
Well, let's go out on this. Thanks for thanks for doing this.
Yeah, it's really awesome. Anytime. Next week?
Sure. Come to a tiny desk with John Prine. How's that?
All right.
All right. Deal. You heard it.
Deal.
Seems clear to me.
Somewhere.